readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. These past weeks, we've done a thorough job of investigating American suspense writers topping the bestseller list. But take a quick glance at the current chart, and you'll see a significant number of titles from the UK. These authors are making waves across the pond, and that impact is rippling across our shores. An example, my guest today, mastermind of the Dublin Murder Squad series, Tana French. We'll speak to her about her new title, The Secret Place. So stay with me as we preview both new titles from well-loved favorites and are introduced to several British writers who've been, until now, a mystery to us. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the book report. Begin today's book report with a popular British author, Deborah Crombie, who has 18 books in her Duncan Kincaid and Gemma James series. This will be, I'm shamefaced to admit, my first. To Dwell in Darkness delivers a powerful tale of intrigue, betrayal, and lies that plunge married London detectives Kincaid and James into the darkness that lies at the heart of murder. Recently transferred to Camden from Scotland Yard headquarters, Kincaid and his new murder investigation team are called to a deadly bombing at the historic St. Pancras station. The victim was taking part in a protest, yet his colleagues swear the young man only meant to set off a smoke bomb. As Kincaid begins to gather the facts, he finds every piece of the puzzle yields an unexpected pattern, including the disappearance of a mysterious bystander. The bombing isn't the only mystery troubling Kincaid. He's still questioning the reasons behind his transfer. When his former boss is attacked, those suspicions deepen. Kincaid begins to untangle the truth, but his discoveries leave him doubting the job that has shaped his life. Gerard Doyle performs the book.
Returning to Scotland Yard from paternity leave in mid-February, he'd found his office empty. He'd been transferred from his long-time job as head of a homicide liaison team at the Yard to an area major incident team based here in Holborn. It was a demotion, although he had kept his rank. There had been no warning and no explanation. His immediate superior, Chief Superintendent Dennis Childs, had been called out of the country on a family emergency. That had added a second worry atop the first, as Kincaid and his family had been letting Childs' sister Liz's home in Notting Hill, while her husband worked a 5-year contract in Singapore. Kincaid had come to like Liz Davies, although they had only communicated via email. He hoped that the out-of-the-country emergency didn't include her. With Kincaid's transfer to Holborn, Doug Cullen, Kincaid's detective sergeant, had been moved into a data entry job at the Yard, ostensibly to accommodate his recovery from a broken ankle. Now Kincaid faced adjusting to a new job without Cullen's capable, nerdy presence. Losing a good detective sergeant, a partner with whom you spent more hours than you did with your spouse, ranked in his opinion close to divorce on the scale of life disruptions, and there'd been no compensating honeymoon with his new team. As if conjured up by his thoughts, he glimpsed his new detective constable, George Sweeney, trotting down the steps of the LA fitness gym across the street from the police station. Fresh from his morning workout, Sweeney wore a 3-piece suit that was too expensive for a constable's salary, and no overcoat. His short hair was still damp and trendily spiked, his cheeks red from his healthy exertion. "Morning, Governor," Sweeney said, overly hearty, as they both reached the station entrance. "You look like death warmed over," he added, squinting at Kincaid. "A little too much partying," Sweeney added with a wink, and what came much too close to a nudge. By God, the man was irritating. "Sick child," Kincaid said shortly. Their 3-year-old foster daughter Charlotte had a bad cough, and he and Gemma had taken turns to sit up with her. "Oh, well," Sweeney shrugged. "That means the day can only get better, right, Gov?" Kincaid felt a sting on his cheek, and then another. The lowering sky had begun to spit sleet. I'm not wearing a bloody cardigan, said Andy Monaghan. His face was set in the mulish expression Detective Sergeant Melody Talbot had come to recognise in the less than 2 months they'd been a couple. It had taken all her powers of persuasion to get him into the trendy clothing shop in Soho. As Andy studied himself in the mirror, she crossed her fingers behind her back. At least he hadn't taken it off. He lifted a lapel, his lip curling in distaste. I look like somebody's granddad. All I need is a regimental tie. In his late 20s, with rumpled blonde hair, dark blue eyes, and a face that might be thought pretty, if not for its intensity, Andy looked like a rock star girls would swoon over. You roll up the sleeves and wear it with a white T-shirt and Levi's, Melody insisted. And you certainly don't look like my granddad. He refused the flirtatious bait. I look like Liberace's granddad. The damn thing is baby blue. No rhinestones, though, she said, grinning. And it brings out the colour of your eyes. Besides, Melody added, going in for the kill, you can't possibly let Poppy outdo you. Trust me. Andy gave her an assessing glance. You're the woman who wears super detective suits to work. I should trust your fashion advice? But his mouth had relaxed, and there was a hint of a twinkle in his blue eyes. If I buy it, will you come to the gig? I'll be there. I promised I'd come.
We've just heard To Dwell in Darkness by Deborah Crombie. Let's fill another hole in my reading life. Susan Hill's Simon Surrailer thrillers. The Soul of Discretion is book 8 in the popular series, which I am just discovering. The cathedral town of Lafferton seems idyllic, but sadly shares the same hopes and fears and the same kinds of crime as other English towns. Simon is called in by Lafferton's new chief constable, Kieran Bright. He is asked to take the lead role in a complex, potentially dangerous undercover operation. Simon must leave town immediately without telling anyone, not even his girlfriend Rachel, who has only just moved in with him. As the op unfolds, Lafferton is dragged into the sort of case every town dreads, and Simon is facing the fight of his life. Stephen Pacey narrates.
It seemed such a little time ago. They'd often gone out, had a drink at the Ox, met friends for bingo, a walk to the hill when the evenings were light, even a spin in the car to one of the village pubs. They'd gone to a film occasionally, had a fish and chip supper on the way back. Having no children, sorry though they both were, meant a bit more money for them to enjoy treats together. Tom had worked hard all his life. She'd had part-time work so that she could be in with his tea on the table when he got home. Jean Mason stood waiting for the kettle to boil. Such a little time ago. She remembered everything, and Tom remembered nothing. Most days now he didn't even remember her. Most days there seemed no point in even going to see him because it upset them both. He kept asking her who she was and why Jean hadn't been to visit him. She couldn't think of a thing to say to this man she no longer knew. This wasn't Tom, the Tom she'd known since they were both 11, the person she'd shared her entire adult life with, day in, day out. So who was it? She poured boiling water into the teapot and took her tray through. They had never been a noisy couple, and the street had always been a quiet street, but now it was uncanny, the empty silence. They had lived in the flat above the shop for the last 10 years, since their old street had been demolished. When they came, there had been a dozen shops in the row, laundrette, baker, butcher, greengrocer, hardware, and then a Chinese takeaway, a minicab office. Below them had been a wool shop, then a toy shop, then a cafe. One by one, they'd all closed. Now there was a charity shop at one end, a letting agency office at the other, and in between, nothing but windows boarded up. It was lonely and it was bleak, and Tom had said they'd try and find somewhere else. But where else was there? So long as he'd been well, she hadn't minded. She minded now. She started to watch a crime drama, but it was too violent, turned over to a comedian who was too crude. The last 10 minutes of a cookery programme was entertaining enough, but after that she switched off. She would go to bed with a book she'd bought from the charity shop, Travels with My Elephant. She loved animals. She loved reading about places she would never see. Tom would have picked it up, smiled, teased her about it. Now he had forgotten how to smile. A child was screaming. She went to the window, but the street was empty and silent. She opened the window. Nothing. It had stopped. Maybe it was a cat, a fox. The foxes still came scavenging round. As she was getting into bed 10 minutes later, she heard the scream again, and this time it was in the street. This time there were people. A car pulled up outside the boarded-up shop next door, two men, one of them pulling a small child by the hand. They were too far from the street lamp for her to see clearly, and in a few seconds the child was pushed into the car, one of the men in the back with it, and the car was moving away, accelerating fast as it reached the corner. Then nothing. The street was silent, empty, dark. Jean wondered if she had been hallucinating, or was half asleep, and somehow begun to dream while still awake. Did that happen? She went back to her bed, but when she tried to read, the image of the child being pulled towards the car came between her and the words, and the sound of its cry seemed to echo again and again through her head. She wondered what she should do. She knew what she ought to do, but her story sounded so fanciful that she could not bring herself to make the call. It was 4 nights later that the child screamed again. There was no car in the street. The sound came from somewhere nearby, but indoors. And almost as soon as she heard it, the noise stopped quite suddenly. Then nothing. Jean lay for a long time listening, but the only sound she heard was the beat of her own heart.
That was The Soul of Discretion by Susan Hill. Tana French was born in the U.S., but lived in numerous countries as a child, including Ireland, Italy, the U.S., and Malawi. Her dad was an economist who worked around the developing world, so the family lived in many different countries. Tana attended Trinity College Dublin and was trained in acting. She ultimately settled in Ireland and has made Dublin her home since 1990. Tana's novel Broken Harbor won the 2012 LA Times Book Prize for Best Mystery Thriller and the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction. Previous titles have garnered numerous awards, including the Edgar, Anthony, and Barry Awards. Today we'll speak with her about her latest bestseller, The Secret Place, from the Dublin Murder Squad series. Welcome, Tana. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Introduce us to St. Kilda's School and Holly, Becca, Selena, and Julia.
St. Kilda's School is a private girls' boarding school, small, elite, on the outskirts of Dublin. And Holly and Selena and Becca and Julia are four girls who are 15 at the beginning of the book, 16 by the end, who are close friends in a way that I think you only really get when you're that age, when people, you've got these friends who know absolutely everything about you. You at your most disorganized, most floundering for identity, they know all the worst, silliest, messiest sides of you, and they love you anyway. But for these girls, that friendship goes farther and becomes even more powerful.
Right. What were the challenges of writing an entire book within the geographic confines of a girls' private school?
I actually like geographic confines. I think if you write a book within quite a tight, isolated environment, it helps to intensify the atmosphere. It becomes distilled. The atmosphere becomes a presence within the book, almost a character in itself. And I really like that. It also, it keeps the pressure on in a way. It keeps the pressure on the detectives. It keeps the pressure on the girls. It means that nobody can escape from the plot or from the world of the book. So I enjoy that. But yeah, it was kind of a challenge getting it right, because I never went to a boarding school. You know, I had no experience of this. So I was researching for every boarding school in Dublin. I was researching on the web to try and get things like the layout of the rooms or the timetable for the boarders, trying to get that stuff right.
Right. You mentioned the detectives. Talk a bit about Antoinette Conway and Stephen Moran. They had a very unusual alliance. Describe it for us.
Yes, they're not really an ideal match as far as they're concerned. Antoinette Conway is, she's tough, she's abrasive, she is not going to let anybody else tell her who she is or how she should behave. And she's on the murder squad, which is very much a man's world, and very, at the moment anyway, and very much not a working class world. And she is a woman, very solidly working class. And she's not willing to bend in any way to make her own life easier. Whereas Stephen is, he's essentially a people pleaser. He will be or do just about anything that will smooth the way for himself, because he's also very ambitious. And just to make life a little nicer. So neither one of them wants the other one around, but they are stuck with each other. And over the course of the book, they start to realize that actually they don't repel each other quite as much as they thought.
What is the secret place you describe in the book?
Well, literally, it is a notice board in the school on which the girls can pin up any secrets they have anonymously. I mean, things like, oh, I hate my parents, or I'm madly in love with Robert Pattinson, or whatever it might be. At the time, it sprang from a website called Post Secret, which is much the same thing, only on a cyber level. People can send in their secrets on postcards, secrets that they want to reveal anonymously, and the site owner puts them up. And I was looking at that website and thinking, that's amazing. It touches on this very deep two-way human pull to reveal our secrets, but at the same time to keep them private. And that website allows you to do both. It's an amazing thing. And I started thinking about, you know, adolescence, which is the time when those two needs, I think, are most intense. And what would happen if a bunch of teenagers had access to a physical board that fulfilled the same purpose? And that, you know, I write crime, you kind of have to throw in a murder somewhere. I started thinking, what if a teenager used a board like that to reveal what he or she knew about a murder?
I see. Dublin's murder squad has a persistent undercurrent of tension, of shifting alliances and rivalries. Do you have insiders within a police department who helped you get this conflict right?
I have an ex-insider who who used to be a detective on the, well, there isn't a Dublin murder squad, but he used to be a detective in the Irish police force. He's retired now, and he's amazing. Not only does he answer the actual questions I have, but he tells me stories. And that, I think, is how you get a sense of atmosphere, is how you get a sense of the answers to the questions you didn't even know you needed to ask. And he's not describing any of the kind of tension and spats and jockeying for position, but I think that's an inherent part of any closed circle environment where people are doing something that's really, really high stakes. I mean, the stakes for especially a murder detective are almost unimaginable. I mean, if I do my job wrong one day, there are too many adjectives, whereas if they do their job wrong, someone could die or go to jail for a crime of which they're innocent. You know, the stakes are incredibly high, and I think that leads to a very high level of tension. So I think it's a little less high in the real Garda Síochána, the Irish police force, because there isn't a specific murder squad. There's a National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which is much broader and less kind of hothouse, less intense. But in a small murder squad that's the elite and that's dealing with the worst thing a human being can do to another, I think tensions are going to run high.
Yes. As a child, you lived all over the world. What impact do you think this has on your writing?
I think the biggest impact is probably in my sense of place and my relationship with places when I write about them. I mean, I never had anywhere that I would have considered really deeply a home. I don't feel like I have a right to claim any specific place as my home, because there's nowhere where I was born and brought up and my parents come from, you know. I don't have anywhere like that. And that's left me fascinated with places and what having deep roots in a place can mean to a person. I think it's probably most obvious in Faithful Place, which is my third book, which is set in a community that goes back generations and where everybody knows everybody's grandparents and stories about them, and, you know, everyone knows each other at that level. But even in all of my other books, including Secret Place, I think that's a factor in why location becomes a character, because I am so fascinated by a place and what it does to a person growing up in it, because I never had a specific place that I could call mine. I'm always watching places and what they mean to people.
I see. Are you already at work on your next novel?
Yes, I am. It's my sixth book, and Antoinette Conway, who shows up in The Secret Place, she's the narrator this time. And she and Stephen are partners now. They're on the murder squad. And she is still not playing well with others. And they get a case that looks like a routine domestic murder. But gradually they start to realize that someone on their own squad doesn't want them solving this. And they have to work out, is it because they really want to get rid of Antoinette so badly, and if so, who wants to get rid of her that badly and why? Or is there something else going on?
Well, we'll certainly look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Bye now.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. And now let's listen to a sampling of The Secret Place, Book 5 of The Dublin Murder Squad, performed by Stephen Hogan and Lara Hutchison.
Glued below his face, across his blue T-shirt, words cut out of a book, spaced wide like a ransom note. Neat edges, snipped close. I know who killed him. Holly watching me, silent. I turned the envelope over. Plain white card, the kind you can buy anywhere to print off your photos. No writing, nothing. I said, "Did you touch it?" Eyes to the ceiling. "Course not. I went into the art room and got that," the envelope, "and a balsa knife. I pulled out the tack with the knife, and I caught the card and the tack in the envelope. Well done. And then? I put it up my shirt till I got back to my room, and then I put it in the folder. Then I said I felt sick and went back to bed. After the nurse came round, I sneaked out and came here." I asked, "Why?" Holly gave me an eyebrows upstairs. "Because I thought you guys might want to know. If you don't care, then you can just throw it away, and I can get back to school before they find out I'm gone."
"I care. I'm only delighted you found this. I'm just wondering why you didn't take it to one of your teachers or your dad."
A glance up at the wall clock, catching the video camera on the way. "Crap. That actually reminds me. The nurse comes round again at break time, and if I'm not there, they will freak out. Can you phone the school and say you're my dad and I'm with you? Say my granddad's dying, and when you rang to tell me, I did a runner without telling anyone because I didn't want to get sent to the guidance counsellor to talk about my feelings."
"All worked out for me."
"I'll ring the school now. I'm not going to say I'm your dad, though."
Exasperated explosion of sigh from Holly.
"I'll just say you had something you wanted to pass on to us, and you did the right thing. That should keep you out of hassle, yeah?"
"Whatever. Can you at least tell them I'm not allowed to talk about it, so they won't bug me?"
"No problem." Chris Harper, still laughing at me. Enough energy running in the turn of those shoulders to power half Dublin. I slid him back in the folder, closed it over.
"Did you tell anyone about this? Your best friend, maybe? It's grand if you did, I just need to know."
A shadow sliding down the curve of Holly's cheekbone, turning her mouth older, less simple, layering something under her voice. "No, I didn't tell anyone."
"Okay. I'm going to make this call, and then I'll take your statement. Do you want one of your parents to sit in?"
That brought her back.
"Oh, Jesus, no. Does someone have to sit in? Can't you just do it?"
"What age are you?"
She thought about lying, decided against it.
16.
"We need an appropriate adult. Stop me intimidating you."
"You don't intimidate me."
"I know, yeah, still. You hang on here, make yourself a cup of tea if you fancy one. They'll be back in 2 minutes.
Holly thumped down on the sofa, coiled into a twist,
legs curled under, arms wrapped round, pulled the end of her ponytail round to the front and started biting it. The building was boiling, as per usual, but she looked cold. She didn't watch me leave. Sex crime. 2 floors down. Keep a social worker on call. I got her in, took Holly's statement, asked your woman in the corridor afterwards, would she drive Holly back to St. Kilda's? Holly gave me the daggers for that. I said, this way your school knows for definite you were actually with us. You didn't just get a boyfriend to ring in. Save you hassle. Her look said I didn't fool anyone. She didn't ask me what next, what we were going to do about the card. She knew better. She just said,
see you soon.
Thanks for coming in. You did the right thing. Holly didn't answer that. Just gave me the edge of a smile and a little wave, half sarcastic, half not.
That was The Secret Place by Tana French. Shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize 3 times, Sarah Waters has earned a prized reputation for historical fiction. In The Paying Guest, she delivers again. Reviewers are calling the book a love story, a tension-filled crime story, and a beautifully atmospheric portrait of a fascinating time and place. The London of 1922 is a dense, dissatisfied place. Ex-servicemen are disillusioned. The out of work are demanding change. And people are going hungry in every corner of the city. In a genteel villa now bereft of brothers, husband, and servants, life is about to change. The impoverished widow, Mrs. Ray, and her spinster daughter, Frances, are obliged to take in lodgers. With the arrival of Lillian and Leonard Barber, a modern young couple of the clerk class, the routines of the house will be shaken up in unexpected ways. As passions mount and frustration gathers, the disturbances will be both far-reaching and devastating. Juliet Stevenson narrates.
Her dark hair was short, curling forward over her cheeks, but shingled at the nape of her neck like a clever black cap. How young they looked. The men seemed no more than boys, though Francis had guessed on his other visit that Mr. Barber must be 26 or 27, about the same age as herself. Mrs. Barber she'd put at 23. Now, she wasn't so sure. Crossing the flagged front garden, she heard their excited, unguarded voices. They had drawn a trunk from the van and set it unsteadily down. Mr. Barber had apparently caught his fingers underneath it. "Don't laugh," she heard him cry to his wife in mock complaint. She remembered then their refined elocution class accents. Mrs. Barber was reaching for his hand. "Let me see. Oh, there's nothing." He snatched the hand back. "There's nothing now. You just wait a bit. Christ, that hurts!" The other man rubbed his nose. "Look out." He had seen Frances at the garden gate. The barbers turned and greeted her through the tail of their laughter, so that the laughter, not very comfortably, somehow attached itself to her. "Here you are, then," she said, joining the three of them on the pavement. Mr. Barber, still almost laughing, said, "Yes, here we are, bringing down the character of the street already, you see." "Oh, my mother and I do that." Mrs. Barber spoke more sincerely. "We're sorry we're late, Miss Ray. The time just flew. You haven't been waiting. You'd think we'd come from John O'Groats or somewhere, wouldn't you?" They had come from Peckham Rye, about 2 miles away. Francis said, "Sometimes the shortest journeys take longest, don't they?"
"They do," said Mr. Barber, "if Lillian's involved in them. Mr. Wismuth and I were ready at 1. This is my friend, Charles Wismuth, who's kindly lent us the use of his father's van for the day."
"You weren't ready at all," cried Mrs. Barber, as a grinning Mr. Wismuth moved forward to shake Francis's hand. "Miss Ray, they weren't, honestly."
"We were ready and waiting while you were still sorting through your hats."
"At any rate," said Francis, "you're here now." Perhaps her tone was rather a cool one. The three young people looked faintly chastened, and with a glance at his injured knuckles, Mr. Barber returned to the back of the van. Over his shoulder, Francis caught a glimpse of what was inside it. A mess of bursting suitcases, a tangle of chair and table legs, bundle after bundle of bedding and rugs, a portable gramophone, a wicker birdcage, a bronze-effect ashtray on a marbled stand. The thought that all these items were about to be brought into her home, and that this couple, who were not quite the couple she remembered, who were younger and brasher, were going to bring them and set them out and make their own home brashly among them. The thought brought on a flutter of panic. What on earth had she done? She felt as though she was opening up the house to thieves and invaders. But there was nothing else for it, if the house were to be kept going at all. With a determined smile, she went closer to the man, wanting to help. The men wouldn't let her.
You mustn't think of it, Miss Ray.
No, honestly, you mustn't, said Mrs. Barber. Len and Charlie will do it. There's hardly anything, really.
And she gazed down at the objects that were accumulating around her, tapping at her mouth with her fingers. Frances remembered that mouth now. It was a mouth, as she'd put it to herself, that seemed to have more on the outside than on the in. It was touched with colour today, as it hadn't been last time, and Mrs. Barber's eyebrows, she noticed, were thinned and shaped. The stylish details made her uneasy, along with everything else, made her feel old maidish with her pinned-up hair and her angles, and her blouse tucked into her high-waisted skirt after the fashion of the war, which was already 4 years over.
We've just heard The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters. Speaking of the Man Booker Prize, let's preview The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher from two-time Man Booker Award winner Hilary Mantel. Reviewers have found this collection of short stories to be a departure from Mantel's incredibly popular Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. The collection, performed by Jane Carr, includes a ghost story, a vampire tale, a near memoir, and a mini family saga. Each brilliantly unsettles the listener with Mantel's classic wicked humor.
Mohammed Ijaz, import-export. I am so sorry to disturb your afternoon. I am totally lost. Would you permit use of your telephone? I stood aside to let him in. No doubt I smiled. Given what would ensue, I must suppose I did. Of course, if it's working today. I walked ahead and he followed, talking. An important deal. He had almost closed it. Visit to client in person necessary. Time, he worked up his sleeve and consulted a fake Rolex, time running out. He had the address. Again, he patted his pockets. But the office is not where it should be. He spoke into the telephone in rapid Arabic, fluent, aggressive, his eyebrows shooting up. Finally, shaking his head, he put down the receiver, looked at it in regret, then up at me with a sour smile. Weak mouth, I thought. Almost a handsome man, but not. Slim, sallow, easily thrown. "I am in your debt, madam," he said. "Now I must dash." I wanted to offer him a what? Bathroom break? Comfort stop? I had no idea how to phrase it. The absurd phrase, wash and brush up, came into my mind. But he was already heading for the door. Though from the way the call had concluded, I thought that they might not be so keen to see him at his destination as he was to see them. "This crazy city," he said. "They are always digging up the streets and moving them. I am so sorry to break in on your privacy." In the hall he darted another glance around and up the stairs. "Only the British will ever help you." He skidded across the hall and prized open the outer door with its heavy ironwork screen, admitting for a moment the dull roar of traffic from Medina Road. The door swung back. He was gone. I closed the hall door discreetly and melted into the oppressive hush. The air conditioner rattled away like an old relative with a loose cough. The air was heavy with insecticide. Sometimes I sprayed it as I walked, and it fell about me like bright mists, veils. I resumed my phrasebook and tape. Fifth lesson. I'm living in Jeddah. I'm busy today. God give you strength. When my husband came home in the afternoon, I told him, a lost man was here, Pakistani businessman. I let him in to phone. My husband was silent. The air conditioner hacked away. He walked into the shower, having evicted the cockroaches, walked out again, dripping, naked, lay on the bed, stared at the ceiling. Next day, I swept the business card into a bin. In the afternoon, the doorbell rang again. Ijaz had come back to apologize, to explain, to thank me for rescuing him. I made him some instant coffee and he sat down and told me about himself. It was then June 1983. I had been in Saudi Arabia for 6 months. My husband worked for a Toronto-based company of consulting geologists and had been seconded by them to the Ministry of Mineral Resources. Most of his colleagues were housed in family compounds of various sizes, but the single men and a childless couple like ourselves had to take what they could get. This was our second flat. The American bachelor, who had occupied it before, had been moved out in haste. Upstairs in this block of four flats lived a Saudi civil servant with his wife and baby. The fourth flat was empty. On the ground floor across the hall from us lived a Pakistani accountant who worked for a government minister, handling his personal finances. Meeting the womenfolk in the hall or on the stairs, one blacked out head to toe, one partly veiled, the bachelor had livened up their lives by calling, "Hello!" or possibly, "Hi there!"
That was The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher by Hilary Mantel. The Children Act by Ian McEwan is the emotionally wrenching new title from the author of Atonement. Fiona May is a London High Court judge presiding over cases in family court. She is fiercely intelligent, well-respected, and deeply immersed in the nuances of her field of law. But Fiona's professional success belies domestic strife. Her husband, Jack, asks her to consider an open marriage and, after an argument, moves out of the house. His departure leaves her adrift, wondering whether it was not love she'd lost so much as respectability, whether it is contempt and ostracism she really fears. She decides to throw herself into her work, especially a complex case involving a 17-year-old boy whose Jehovah's Witness parents will not permit a life-saving blood transfusion. The pressure to resolve the case, as well as her crumbling marriage, tests Fiona in ways that will keep listeners turning pages. Lindsay Duncan performs the book.
The family division teemed with strange differences, special pleading, intimate half-truths, exotic accusation. And as in all branches of law, fine-grained particularities of circumstance needed to be assimilated at speed. Last week, she heard final submissions from divorcing Jewish parents, unequally orthodox, disputing their daughter's education. The draft of her completed judgment was on the floor beside her. Tomorrow, coming before her again, would be a despairing Englishwoman, gaunt, pale, highly educated, mother of a 5-year-old girl, convinced, despite assurances to the court to the contrary, that her daughter was about to be removed from the jurisdiction by the father, a Moroccan businessman and strict Muslim, to a new life in Rabat, where he intended to settle. Otherwise, routine wrangles over residence of children, over houses, pensions, earnings, inheritance. It was the larger estates that came to the High Court. Wealth mostly failed to bring extended happiness. Parents soon learned the new vocabulary and patient procedures of the law and were dazed to find themselves in vicious combat with the one they once loved. And waiting off stage, boys and girls, first named in the court documents, troubled little Bens and Sarahs, huddling together while the gods above them fought to the last, from the family proceedings court to the High Court to the Court of Appeal. All this sorrow had common themes. There was a human sameness to it, but it continued to fascinate her. She believed she brought reasonableness to hopeless situations. On the whole, she believed in the provisions of family law. In her optimistic moments, she took it as a significant marker in civilization's progress, to fix in the statutes the child's needs above its parents. Her days were full, and in the evenings recently, various dinners, something at Middle Temple for a retiring colleague, a concert at King's Place, Schubert, Scriabin, and taxis, tube trains, dry cleaning to collect, a letter to draft about a special school for the cleaning lady's autistic son, and finally, sleep. Where was the sex? At that moment, she couldn't recall. I don't keep a record. He spread his hands, resting his case. She had watched as he crossed the room and poured himself a measure of scotch, the Talisker she was drinking now. Lately, he was looking taller, easier in his movements. While his back was turned to her, she had a cold premonition of rejection, of the humiliation of being left for a young woman, of being left behind, useless and alone. She wondered if she should simply go along with anything he wanted, then rejected the thought. He had come back towards her with his glass. He wasn't offering her a sanseur the way he usually did around this time. What do you want, Jack? I'm going to have this affair. You want a divorce? No, I want everything the same. No deception. I don't understand. Yes, you do. Didn't you once tell me that couples in long marriages aspire to the condition of siblings? We've arrived, Fiona. I've become your brother. It's cosy and sweet, and I love you. But before I drop dead, I want one big, passionate affair. Mistaking her amazed gasp for laughter, for mockery perhaps, he said roughly, ecstasy, almost blacking out with the thrill of it. Remember that? I want one last go, even if you don't. Or perhaps you do. She stared at him in disbelief.
We've just heard a sampling of The Children Act by Ian McEwan. Blood on the Water is Anne Perry's 20th William Monk mystery. The story begins as Monk witnesses the horrifying explosion of the pleasure boat Princess Mary, which took 200 on board to their deaths. The tragedy is no accident. As commander of the River Police, Monk should handle the case, but the investigation is turned over to the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. An Egyptian man is swiftly caught, tried, and sentenced to die. But almost as quickly, Monk presents evidence that the accused was elsewhere at the time of the blast. The investigation, now in complete disarray, is hastily turned over to Monk. Is the crime connected with the soon-to-be-opened Suez Canal? Did all of those innocent people drown to ensure the murder of only one of them? Is the bomber an anarchist or a madman? Backed up by his astute wife, Hester, and his friend, Oliver Rathbone, Monk vows to find answers. Instead, he finds himself treading the dangerous waters of international intrigue, his questions politely turned aside by a formidable array of the powerful and privileged. Events twist and turn, leading to the moment when Monk realizes he may be the next target. David Colaci narrates.
It was only minutes after the explosion when the last of the boats slid into the dark river and disappeared. There was nothing left but the cries, the debris, and the bodies, some motionless, some still fighting to stay above the water. Other boats were coming. A ferry was less than 40 feet away. As it swung around and the men reached over to pull people from the water, the fading sunlight momentarily illuminated a picture and a name painted on the stern. A barge was making its way slowly, dragged against the current as it came closer. The bargee was bending and reaching out to help those closest to him. A small coal freighter was flinging barrels and scrap wood overboard, anything that anyone in the water could clutch onto to help them float before their imprisoning clothes dragged them still screaming under. Monk and Orm had heaved 6 exhausted people out of the water, but that was all they dared carry. Sick with misery, they had to beat off those whose weight would have sunk the boat. Monk had to forcibly push one man away from the gunwales with the blade of his oar, afraid that he would overturn the boat in his frantic attempt to climb aboard. They pulled for the shore, hearing the repeated thanks of the survivors who were huddled together, trying to assist one another in the body of the boat, holding up those barely conscious. Men on the banks were wading as far as they could, roped together, stretching out to lift and help. Monk and Orm went back out again into the near darkness, directed now as much by cries as by sight. They pulled several more people out of the water and rowed them ashore. Monk lost all track of time. He was wet to the skin and so cold he was shaking, yet he and Orm could not give up. If there was even one person still alive in that black water, then they must find him or her. It seemed every man in the river police was here with them, and all manner of others joined in, united in their horror and grief. The banks were lined with people offering aid. Some pushed mugs of hot tea and whiskey into freezing hands, helping the rescued to hold on and drink. Others had blankets. Some even had their own spare dry clothes. The moon was high in the sky when Monk and Orm finally moored the boat and climbed wearily up the steps from the river to the level dockside, acknowledging in a glance that they had done all they could. The wind had risen and scythed across the open stretch in front of the Wapping police station, which was their headquarters. Monk hunched into his coat instinctively, but it was pointless when everything he wore was soaking wet. He increased his pace. Weary as he was, the cold was worse. He could hardly feel his feet and all his bones ached. The palms of his hands were blistered, so he could barely move them. He reached the door with Orm a step behind him. Inside, the wood stove was lit. The air was blessedly warm. Sergeant Jackson came bustling toward them immediately, attending to Monk first, as rank demanded. "You better get them clothes off, sir. We got plenty of dry ones in the cupboard." "Not your taste, sir, being a bit of a dandy like you are. But dry's all that matters now, or you'll catch your death. Begging your pardon, sir, but you look like hell." Monk was shaking so hard his teeth were chattering, and it was beyond his control to stop. "I thought hell was supposed to be hot," he said with an attempt at a smile. "No, sir, cold and wet. Ask any seaman, he'll tell you," Jackson replied. He turned to Orm. "You too, Mr. Orm. You don't look no better. When you come out, I'll have an hot mug of tea for you with a good dash of whiskey in it." "A very good dash, if you please," Monk added. He wanted the fire of it to take the edge off the horror inside him, the pity and guilt he felt for those he had not saved. He sat down and let the warmth of the fire wrap around him like a blanket, for a moment obliterating everything else.
We've just heard Ann Perry's Blood on the Water. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed today's journey across the pond. Our UK neighbors bring so much to the literary landscape. For more titles from around the world, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.